Hello, and welcome to Conversations with me, Dr. Theo Blackmore, part of the Discover Voices Media Network. And today I am talking to...
Hi, my name is Kush Kanodia, and I'm a social entrepreneur who transforms systems to make them more inclusive for disabled people.
Brilliant, fantastic. So there's a whole set of things there that I'd like you to unpack and explain. So you say you're a social entrepreneur?
Yeah, so a social entrepreneur I describe as somebody who, rather than just focuses on making monetary value like a traditional entrepreneur, is also equally focused on creating social value. So I work with lots of charities, nonprofits, and social enterprises. I've kind of developed four portfolios that covers tech, covers sports, covers health, and kind of inclusion, equality and inclusion. But the common thread through all the work that I do is disability and inclusion. So I am a disabled person. I've had a disability since childhood.
So that's amazing. So social entrepreneur, so that's kind of the voluntary sector to a large degree, isn't it? Lots of voluntary sector organisations class themselves, I guess, as social entrepreneurial organisations.
Yeah, I work predominantly with voluntary sector, but the work that I do, because it focuses on systems change, then I also do a lot of lobbying work with national government, with regional government and local government. So I guess it's quite a unique, I'm quite a unique social entrepreneur in that sense. Because it's got a significant focus on transforming systems.
So when you talk about transforming systems, what does that mean then? What kinds of systems are you transforming?
So far I've been involved in three significant systems change transformations. So the first one, when I was a trustee with a charity called Level Playing Field, they were focusing on making all the Premier League football clubs more proportionally representational to the number of wheelchair users in society. So you could take a large football club like Chelsea in Stamford Bridge, a 40,000-seater stadium. And technically, if they just had one or two wheelchair spaces, an accessible toilet and an accessible entrance, they're meeting the Equality Act. But it wasn't proportionally representational to the number of wheelchair users in society. Yeah. And so football clubs essentially look at profit and loss. For each wheelchair space they have, they can have the equivalent of 6 to 8 non-wheelchair spaces. So it was a real battle to try to how to transform that system. I joined kind of halfway through the campaign, but I kind of essentially learnt the how to transform a system. So a grassroots user-led organization of disabled people, disabled fans, working with media organizations and politicians, passing a bill in the House of Lords, and then kind of becoming friends with the director for the redevelopment of Chelsea Football Club. And the two biggest offenders were Chelsea and Manchester United. And when Chelsea agreed, Manchester United also agreed. So I guess I was a bit like a super sub coming in at half time and maybe winning, like scoring the winning goal for like a Champions League game.
So that's amazing. So I knew somebody, and I think he worked at Arsenal. He was a wheelchair user, and his job was to increase inclusion for wheelchair users at the stadium. Wonderful. So I mean, how many spaces would you then put into a stadium for wheelchair users on the basis that you're talking about to be representational?
So I think there's like there's an equation that we use depending on the kind of the size of the stadium and the number of seats. I think it's derived from the Olympics and the Paralympics from London 2012 as well. But there's a number of factors to it in regards. It's not I wouldn't say it's directly exactly kind of proportional. There's a number of factors, but I think it's a much better guide and it does help to improve access and inclusion. As a disabled fan myself, so growing up in London, being a small disabled fan, it's also from a BAME kind of minority ethnic background. I remember just going to my first football game, and it just gave me a lot of confidence that if I thought, I kind of thought that if I can survive that environment, probably the most aggressive and atmospheric environment a young disabled person can find themselves, it gave me confidence to kind of go to nightclubs, go to festivals, go traveling. And just really live life and experience life, just thinking that if I can survive that, I can survive anything. And then that also led to then the other systems change work that I did, because I kind of believed that if you can transform a system like the Premier League, a real David and Goliath battle, then why can't you transform other significant systems in the UK? And that's essentially what's happened.
Right. So the other kinds of systems, well, there's lots and lots to talk about there. So, I've spoken on a few podcasts about notions of intersectionality, where somebody who is a disabled person might experience other forms of kind of discrimination and oppression because of other characteristics that they have, one of the protected characteristics. And there are protected characteristics along the lines of race and gender and sexuality. And so you mentioned there that you're from a BAME background. So did you experience that kind of dual oppression, as it were, when you were growing up in London?
Yeah, so when I grew up in London, originally we lived in Hackney. So Hackney's very posh now, but when I grew up there, over 40 years ago, it was considered a ghetto.
Oh, I remember Hackney back in the day. I used had lots of friends in Hackney, and I used to go and hang out there. And it was a great life. I knew people who lived in a squat in Hackney, and there was a really cheap cafe nearby. And it was, you'd like you say, not the posh place that we know today.
Yeah, the police were actually scared to go into Hackney back
But,
then. So it's completely transformed. And I guess that's how a lot of London is. But there was a lot of racism back then as well. And then I moved from there to Chelsea, also quite young. And the racism was a lot more overt back then. So sometimes it's also difficult when you face aggression. You don't necessarily know if the aggression is because I'm an ethnic minority or I have a disability or I'm also shorter in stature. That
yeah,
can
of
also
course.
sometimes.
You're not going to
So,
stop and ask questions, are you, in a situation of aggression?
exactly. So sometimes actually it's very difficult to understand. Is it a combination of factors of the intersectionality, or is it one of them? But I realized that I was receiving a much different kind of response than other people. And I remember just going into a supermarket with my sister one day, and she noticed it, and she was shocked by it. And it can be quite intimidating. So I think sometimes we do need to have a lot of confidence. And that's kind of one of the things I was talking about in the tech summit yesterday, the Control Alt Delete summit, that I really believe our systems are sometimes designed with the energy of fear. And I believe that if you look at, say, the benefit system with a kind of welfare reform and the narrative that sometimes government has in regards to benefits and disability, that confidence is a real key factor for disabled people to kind of break out of this vicious cycle that we sometimes have. And I believe it's the same for intersectionality, that we really need to have a lot of self-confidence and belief to kind of to live our full potential.
Absolutely. It's I mean, in many ways, the benefit system is kind of there to take away confidence, isn't it? It's kind of disempowering in lots of ways. It's a very disempowering situation to find oneself in, I think.
Definitely. So I was reading some report by Sir Michael Marmot, and it was really insightful. He was basically saying that if you're on universal credit, you're basically guaranteed to be sick. because he was saying that universal credit only provides 70% of our basic necessity in regards to heating and eating and kind of the basic necessities in life. So we have this perverse system that they know doesn't provide even the very basics of life, and it's making people sick. And it's getting worse, let's be honest. Like the levels of deprivation and poverty last year, Joseph Rowntree Foundation published a report about approximately 4 million people in the UK living in destitution, and that was figures based on 2012. So I presume the figures would be much higher now. And the other shocking thing about that was two-thirds of the people living in destitution either had long-term health conditions or were disabled people. And if you look at what policies have changed since all these kind of significant stats have come out, you'll realize things have actually got worse, even rather than getting better.
A whole lot worse. I was reading stats from the Trussell Trust, who have a lot of food banks across the country, which have, massively increased in number for a start. But they were saying something like 70% of people who use food banks are people with a long-term limiting illness or a disability.
Exactly.
So that's, the whole thing is horrific, because what you need, obviously, if you do have a long-term limiting illness or disability, is you need good food and you need to be warm, because you need to stay alive at the end of the day.
And then when you look at the statistics for the pandemic, so 60% of all COVID-19 deaths are disabled people, even though the Office of National Statistics states that disabled people amount to 17% of the population. So 17% of the population equating to 60% of the deaths. And you look at what's actually changed since then. So the government talks about leveling up. Like, actually, I could probably say some of the campaigns that I've been involved with and kind of led have been the most significant disability inclusion policy changes to have happened in England and in London. So I really don't know what national governments, regional governments, local government, the public sector have been doing, quite honestly, for the last 5 years, because things are just getting a lot worse for those most in need.
Absolutely. And then central government cuts to local authorities mean that local authorities are just changing across the board. I had an email this morning from a local authority, or from a disabled people's organisation in a local authority in the UK, and they're starting to bring into the equation to calculate whether somebody should be don't giving money towards their own social care costs. They're bringing personal independence payments into that equation now. So people, the reason why people have a personal independence payment is to increase the level of income for a disabled person because of the associated costs or the costs associated with being a disabled person. So me, for example, I use electric scooters. Well, nobody buys me an electric scooter, so they cost 2, 3, 4 thousand pounds. Some of them cost more than cars, and then you have to get them serviced, you have to get batteries, blah blah blah, you have to charge them up every day, so electricity bills are higher. So that's what the personal independence payment goes towards. To bring that into care cost calculations, because local authorities are strapped for cash. I mean, in Cornwall down here, the local authority may declare bankruptcy in the coming year. So that all has a knock-on effect on individual disabled people in a massive way.
I totally agree. And I was actually looking at, I got shared the stats for disabled people in Cornwall. And if I remember correctly, it's 28%. So it's
It's
even like,
much higher, yeah, much higher than the national average.
yeah. So like like disabled people estimate at 20%. Some people say 25, like some government organizations are varying, but it's very true. Like social care is, unfortunately, the critical piece of the health system that government has failed to act upon and has just pushed the can down the road. And the truth is, you can go to hospital, you can get treatment, but if you're not having adequate social care, then it's not going to work. Like, you need the help and the support. And if that's not, if it's not being provided, the people who are affected most, again, are the elderly and disabled people.
In social care categorizations, they have four categories of care, which is kind of low, moderate, substantial, and critical. And most local authorities now only provide either substantial or critical, with the majority, I think, only providing critical now. So the low and moderate care categories essentially don't exist anymore. And I would argue that those categories of care are now being provided by the voluntary sector and by organizations like disabled people's organizations, which are figuring out ways to provide that care on a really narrow budget. So kind of there's other people stepping in to provide the social care which isn't formally being provided anymore.
It feels as though, in some way, there's been a real dereliction of duty by the state. And you can see that with, as you're saying, with DDPOs, deaf and disabled people's organizations providing social care. You can see that with food banks. It should not be the case that we need food banks in such a rich country. So I think there's been real critical questions. And unfortunately, it also feels that the debates that we're having in the country are focusing more on culture wars than actually the key critical questions about poverty, deprivation, and inequality. Doesn't even feel as though we're actually having adequate discussions about the state of play right now in the UK.
I think it's there was a question on Question Time which I watched on television last night, and the question was is Britain falling apart essentially? Is it kind of going down the pan? There's lots of economic forecasts aren't looking good, and lots of other things aren't looking good for the short to medium to long term. And I think you're right, I agree with you that lots of it's just kind of fallen apart because some people have taken their eye off the ball. And that, in many ways, is kind of the situation that minoritized groups find ourselves in. So, as disabled people, I heard somebody, I did a podcast a couple of weeks ago with Colin Barnes, Professor Colin Barnes, and he said, disability isn't a minority status because it's most people will experience some form of impairment at some time in their lives. And it's wrong to call it a minority population in many ways. So the majority of people will experience some kind of deprivation in their lives and will experience impairment in their lives and will go through that tread, that mill, as it were.
Yeah, I would actually honestly say that we will all experience disability in some shape or form in our lives. Because if you look at the stats, they vary from 15 to 25 or even above, like Cornwell. And if you look at the correlation between disability and getting older, so when you're reaching pensioner age, you've already got a 50% chance, and 80% of disabilities are acquired during one's working life. So the truth is, we will all experience disability either through our lived experience or through our friends and family. And what I try to explain to people is when we design for disability, when we design for universal design principles, we're actually designing for us all. So that includes the mother or father pushing a baby in the pram. It includes the person trying to get to the airport with the luggage. It includes the elderly person pushing a trolley for their food. It helps all of us, even with the situational disabilities. But currently, again, it's not a default. Like it's not, it doesn't feel as though, we have things like web accessibility regulations for public sector organizations. But if you look at what percentage of organizations are meeting them, it's a tiny fraction. It needs, like, we need to mandate accessibility audits in the physical and the virtual environment and start to hold these organizations to account. So councils, universities, hospital trusts, and then we can start building environments, physical environments and virtual environments that are accessible and inclusive to us all. And that's basically the work that I do, that I kind of try to transform systems to make them more inclusive and accessible to everybody.
So it's a big old job, the job you do. Is it, do you feel you achieve success in your job? Can you spot markers when you think, oh, well, yes, that was a real benefit that I made. That was a real change that happened because of the work that I do.
Definitely. I think I'm very fortunate that I can actually say that because I think it's very difficult to transform systems. Let's be completely honest. So previously I did a campaign that I'd kind of highlighted, called the No Wheelchair Tax campaign, because I wanted to kind of get the publicity in the newspapers for that. But that essentially transformed NHS England. So it abolished all disabled car parking charges in all NHS hospitals in England. So transforming over 200 NHS hospitals, helping 2.5 million disabled blue badge holders to access critical healthcare. And that was implemented in April 2021, so in the height of the pandemic.
That's a big success. You must have made a massive, great big hand to pat yourself on the back with that one. That's brilliant. Congratulations.
Thank you. It was actually supposed to be implemented in January 2020. So it was going to be implemented right in the beginning of the pandemic, and they delayed it a year, April 2021. But essentially, getting the government to invest £1 billion over a 10-year period. And I knew it was the most significant disability inclusion policy change to happen in England during the pandemic and the cost of living crisis. A couple of years ago, I got an honorary doctorate from Kent University. And during the graduation speech, they're one of the new medical schools. And they said it was the most significant and impactful change in the treatment of disabled people since the founding of the NHS. And
Wow.
the NHS was recently 75 years old.
That's amazing. Well done.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's a big piece of work. I mean, that all of that work that you talk about, changing systems change, just must take a heck of a lot of just toil, sitting down and just doing the graft. It's a thankless task sometimes, isn't it? I think.
That took 3 years, and some of that time was like completely dedicated to this. So some of it was actually like pro bono as a philanthropist because I didn't really receive any formal funding for that, but I knew how significant it was because I'm a disabled person. I've had both my hips replaced. Now they want to replace my shoulders. And I know how critical healthcare is. If I can't access healthcare, then I can't access education, I can't access employment, I can't be a full participant in society. And the NHS's founding principle is accessible for all, free at the point of delivery. And like if you look at London, for example, London, only one third of the tube stations in London are accessible. So we had the perverse, perverse system in England that was actually making it that those most in need could not access healthcare free at the point of delivery. And that's when Scotland had abolished all car parking charges previously. Wales had done the same. But in England, more and more NHS hospital trusts were charging for disabled parking. And obviously, that happened without people really kicking up a fuss. But when I was a governor at Chelsea Westminster and they wanted to charge for disabled parking, I said, if you do that, I'll start a national campaign to abolish all disabled car parking charges. And thankfully, it was successful.
Yeah, that's amazing. To achieve the biggest change in the NHS since the NHS existed, that's a big deal.
For disabled people.
Yeah, absolutely. But then they also raise the issue then about the kind of the intersectionality of everything. So not only is it important to have accessible hospitals and car parking facilities, but also public transport systems to get there. When you talk about the London Underground system being inaccessible essentially for disabled people.
Yeah, so that kind of in some way leads me on to the current campaign. So London implemented the ultra low emission zone, so the world's first ultra low emission zone. So they implemented that in central London in October 2021 during the height of the pandemic. And essentially, like London's ULEZ is a £12.50 charge if the car doesn't meet certain emissions criteria. but they only provided exemptions if the car was tax classified as disabled driver or disabled passenger. But you can only tax classify your car as disabled if you receive the highest rates of benefits. So the category below, with significant mobility impairments, being a blue badge holder or standard rate mobility PIP or DLA, there was no exemptions. And even though they knew the disproportionate impact upon disabled people from the pandemic and the cost of living crisis, they still essentially went ahead with it. So then I started the next campaign that I've been working on for the last 3 years. Last year, we did get success. Like, I think, like, we're halfway there. We got exemptions for a number of Department of Work and Pensions disability benefits, the main one being standard rate mobility PIP, which helps up to 280,000 disabled people in London. We extended grants from 2,000 to 5,000 to 10,000 for wheelchair adapted vehicles. And now we're trying to exempt blue badge holders. So there's approximately 250,000 blue badge holders in London. And now we're trying to also replicate that, creating national policy for the new clean air zones in Birmingham and Bristol that replicated the disability discrimination from London, but not the further reasonable adjustments. And I managed to get that into the new Disability Action Plan that the government launched, the findings of last month, that has a recommendation to exempt blue badge holders from clean air zones and ultra low emission zones. So what I generally say is we're for clean air, it's a human right, but we can have clean air and accessible environments. I say that climate action has to go hand in hand with climate justice and social justice. Otherwise, all we'll do is disproportionately impact those that have already been the most disproportionately impacted in a pandemic and cost of living crisis.
Absolutely, because the people who won't be able to afford to buy the cars with the ultra low emissions will be the poorest people, and the poorest people will be disabled people.
So the cost of the car is one aspect, but then you also can add in the cost of adaptation. So I was speaking to disabled people who were telling me for them to buy a compliant and adapted car could cost anything up to £50,000.
Yeah.
And then you could imagine the impact upon that person. Like, they'd literally be housebound. They wouldn't be able to go to the NHS appointments, social care appointments. They wouldn't be able to go to the shops to visit friends, family. Like, and that is literally the social model of disability, you know, in a great example of the social model of disability, whereas the medical model states that it's our impairment that disables us. The social model of disability states that it's barriers in society and negative attitudes that disable us. So all the campaign work that I do is also based upon the social model of disability, taking away these barriers that are being imposed in our societies.
That's just incredible. And so you were talking about the ultra low emission zones in London and about the impact that has on disabled people.
Yeah, so London introduced the world's first ultra low emission zone in October 2021 without adequate reasonable adjustments for disabled people. So they hadn't given exemptions to blue badge holders or a number of DWP disability benefits. They had basically gone for just what was statutory, just what they legally had to do under law. Which was to exempt cars that were classified as disabled. But the issue there was you can only tax classify your car as disabled if you receive the highest rates of benefits. So to do that in a pandemic where they knew that disabled people were disproportionately impacted and in a cost of living crisis where implementing essentially a £12.50 charge per day to access critical goods and services, primary care, secondary care, social care, to me was just completely unacceptable. I got it looked at by solicitors and barristers, and they said it was potentially violations of the Human Rights Law and the Equality Act. So then ran another campaign in conjunction with Inclusion London, which is a deaf and disabled people's organization in London, had lots of media coverage, and essentially managed to transform Greater London last year. So we got a number of DWP, Department of Work and Pensions disability benefits exempt, the main one being standard rate mobility PIP. That helps up to 280,000 disabled people in London, and extended grants from 2,000 to 5,000 to £10,000. And now we're looking to exempt blue badge holders from London's ULEZ, and also replicate the changes in Bristol and Birmingham that created new clean air zones, but replicated the disability discrimination from London, but not the further reasonable adjustments. So I'm the vice chair for the regional stakeholder network for Greater London with the Disability Unit, and they launched their Disability Action Plan last month. And it's actually in the Disability Action Plan, one of the recommendations is to exempt blue badge holders from all clean air zones and ultra low emission zones in England. So what I say is that we're for clean air. Clean air is a human right, but so is accessible environments. What I say to people, basically, it's not a binary choice between a clean air or accessible environment. Both are, essential aspects of our human rights, and we're for clean air. But we can have both. We can have both clean air and accessible environments. Climate action has to go hand in hand with climate justice and social justice. Otherwise, all we'll do is disproportionately impact those that have already been the most impacted during a pandemic and a cost of living crisis. And slowly, the senior politicians and stakeholders in London are starting to understand this, hence the incremental steps that they've been taking. We haven't got to where we want to. We're hoping we can implement this before the mayoral elections in London on the 2nd of May of this year, and implement national legislation that will mandate it upon the cities within England and the respective mayors before the general election this year.
So that's the only way to do it, isn't it? I think is to make it get it written into legislation, because obviously personnel change all the time, and you must have come across this that you're working with organisations who are rep which are represented by individuals, and the individuals change, and then essentially you may have to start all over again.
That's unfortunately what I found. Even with the NHS, originally it was devolved from NHS England to local trusts. And then what you have is you just have variations. And then some trusts will charge, some trusts won't charge. And then you'll have trends depending on their financial circumstances. And essentially the same is happening with councils. So we know a lot of councils are in a real precarious financial situation. Just look at Birmingham. But the truth is, they still need to follow the law within the UK, the Equality Act and Human Rights Law. And generally, unfortunately, the way is that a lot of times it's the human rights of disabled people that get violated first, because they believe that disabled people have access to less financial means to fight it if it goes to court. And even though I managed to get free, initially, I actually managed to get free legal help, solicitors and barristers to take the matter to a potential judicial review in London about the ultra low emission zone. But even though it was free, they were worried about going ahead with it, because they said if we lost the case, they would be liable to pay the fees for the Mayor of London, the GLA, the Greater London Authority, and the Transport for London. So they didn't go ahead with it. As they said, unless I get legal aid through a disabled person with certain benefits, and that risk was covered, they weren't willing to go ahead and bear that risk of having to pay the other party's legal costs. And that's with actually getting free legal help. So it's there is an inequality of arms even when it comes to applying our rights under the law, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's amazing. And you've spoken so far about the work that you've been doing, and you've couched it in the terms of you as an individual. I imagine, being naive, that you have an entire team behind you or an organization behind you who you work with. But from what you say there, it really is just you kind of going out and ploughing your furrow. Is that the case?
So I think it's a mixture of the two. I think sometimes you do need a person to start a campaign and to lead a campaign, but the truth is you can't transform a system as a person. You know, we can't transform a system with an I. You can only transform a system with a we. So all my campaigns are grassroots campaigns that work with disabled people's organizations. So if we look at the Premier League with level playing fields, if we look at the NHS campaign with Disability Rights UK. If we look at the London ULEZ campaign with Inclusion London, and then there's many, many other deaf and disabled people's organisations that are also supporting and assisting each of these campaigns. So even like if I look at London, I was working with Action for Disability Kensington and Chelsea, their access group. I was working with the City of London's access group. I was working with Mobility Forum within the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea. I was working with the Green Party's disability group. I was working with Inclusion London and their networks. So there's many, many organizations that help to create change, help to create awareness, help to provide case studies and give evidence. The situation is a lot of the times I find that disabled people don't want their name attached to campaigns because we have a climate of fear in regards to the benefit system. So I have lots of people emailing me saying, Kush, I really support your campaign and the work that you do, but I'm not going to put my name like attached to it because disabled people are so fearful. So even when we do crowdfunders and stuff and it impacts a lot of people, I found it's very difficult to get people to sign up just because disabled people's rights have been violated in the UK for such a long time. And even the UN stated there's been a systematic violation of disabled people's rights since austerity. That's unfortunately the state of play. But it only works if we work together in regards to systems change. But it does need a person to start, to take the first step. It does need a person to lead the campaign. It does need a person to speak truth to power originally. And all of it is critical kind of contributions to the overall systems change.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about, so if you are receiving disability benefits, you're essentially receiving a benefit on the basis that you're unable to work. And then if you go and do voluntary work over a certain number of hours, then the DWP turns around and says, hang on a minute, you can work, you are working, and they withdraw your benefits. So it is a very dangerous situation for lots of people.
So I think that's one aspect, but if we also look at the narrative, so if you look at when austerity and welfare reform started, and you look at the media coverage and this narrative around scroungers, you're either a superhero or you're a scrounger, you know, when we had the Olympics.
Yeah.
How many people are going to be like, I don't know, Paralympians? You know, most people are going to be in the middle. But that's not how it's portrayed. So there is this real element of fear amongst disabled people, especially if you're on benefits. So then, if you're campaigning against your local hospital trust or your council or your government, obviously a person's going to be, you know, worried about doing that because they already feel as though they're being attacked from so many different sides. And that's the honest truth. Like even when I was doing this campaigning, a lot of the times I would get responses from the NHS Trust or from London saying, this is your opinion, Kush. What about other people's opinion? And even to get DDPOs or other disabled people until I actually found the right people within these organizations or disabled people willing to speak up, then that's actually what made the real impact. Because then it's not just I, then it's a we. And you can only transform a system as a collective. It's, the NHS is the fifth largest employer in the world, over 1 million employees.
Yeah.
But and if you look at London, it's at 8, 9 million. But the truth is, they pale into comparison, with disabled people. In the UK, we have 16 million disabled people, globally, a population larger than China. So
Yeah.
1.65 billion is maybe the estimate. So when we use our collective power, our collective knowledge and resources, we can achieve anything. Right now, it just feels as though it's a little bit too fragmented.
It's an amazing thing, isn't it? So the actual numbers of disabled people that we're talking about, it's astounding to me that we can be called a minority in that same kind of way, or in that kind of way. But it's just astounding to me how it's that number of people who can effectively just be ignored,
Yeah,
or
and like,
try to ignore at least.
I think, so if you look at, okay, say we're saying disabled people amount to 20% of the population. And then if you look at proportional representation in national government, the number of members of parliament, or the number of peers in the House of Lords, or local government in your council, you'll see that we're nowhere near even 20%. We're struggling to potentially even get to 1%.
Yeah.
And I believe that's the reason disabled people's voices, our lived experience, is ignored, because we do not have proportional representation of disabled people within the bodies of power within our system. When I work with systems value academic experience, they value work experience, they don't value lived experience. And a lot of the times I'm sharing my lived experience, and that's the most critical missing component in the system. The lived experience, when we co-design and co-produce with disabled people, then we create truly inclusive and accessible systems. And that's still not happening, even though you have organizations that talk about patient-centered care, the patient being in the middle, or within councils, based around the public. A lot of the times, unfortunately, is still a tick box exercise. It's not being done in relation to equality of power, in relation to true co-design and true co-production.
So, how do you do this? I mean, you explain the processes and you explain the work that you do, but I mean, do you receive, does somebody pay you? Are you paid by an organization, or is it all voluntarily done, or is just
So
how do you do it?
a lot of the campaigning work I do, quite honestly, is pro bono. It's kind of self-financed. And I finance that now by doing consultancy work, doing contracts. And so when I'm talking or sharing my story at large events, I'm essentially being paid for it in large events. If I'm doing work with deaf and disabled people's organizations, I do that for free. But it's basically all self-financed. And that's why I also believe I honestly don't know, like, what politicians have done since the cost of living crisis and the pandemic. Because I can say that, the two most significant disability inclusion policy changes to happen nationally and regionally during the pandemic and the cost of living crisis are the two campaigns that I've led on. So we have so many people in the public sector within national government, regional government, and local government, and they talk about creating a level playing field. They talk about leveling up. But what are they doing?
Yeah.
I honestly don't know.
That's amazing. So you do your job, you do a day job, and you do the work to do that is required to do to get you in those situations where you're going to be earning money, and then you do all of this other work on top of that. You must spend just all of your time at work. What does leisure time cush look like?
So I go on these silent meditation retreats where I completely kind of switch off for 10 days.
Great.
No phone, no internet, no kind of talking to the outside world. But even sometimes that kind of I get thrust into it. So I was on one of those in 2012, and I get kicked out on day 7 for not having lunch. So I've had no contact with the outside world for 7 days, no phone calls, no emails, no talking essentially. And then I get a phone call from LOCOG, the Olympic Committee, and they said I was the last person to accept to be a torchbearer for the Paralympic Games in London 2012. And if they couldn't contact me that day, they would have had to give this opportunity to somebody else. Do I want to be the last torchbearer for London 2012 Paralympic Games? And that's when I said yes. And that moment really transformed my life. It opened up lots of opportunities for me, but it also, I went through a process that I call reframing. So when I was young, I kind of thought of my disability as a little bit of a curse, maybe being from an Indian kind of culture and background and believing in reincarnation and the kind of things they tell you. So I was thinking, like, why am I smaller? Why am I weaker? Why am I always in pain? Why do my hips always dislocate? And then I went through a kind of career transition from being an investment banker to being a social entrepreneur. But then when I became a torchbearer, I reframed the disability from a negative to a positive, from a curse to a blessing. And I realized that if it wasn't for the disability, I wouldn't be a social entrepreneur. If it wasn't for the disability, I wouldn't be focusing on transforming systems. The disability gives me all these wonderful attributes. It keeps me humble. It keeps me grounded. It keeps me empathetic. It helps me to be a problem solver. And when I reframe the energy, that's actually what really transformed my life. It ended up being rather than something that was holding me down, I realized it was something that was holding me up, and it was giving me direction, meaning, and purpose in my life.
That's an amazing sort of strength of character to be able to do that, to change that negative into a positive. It's not a negative and it's not a positive, but it's changed that framing of it in your mind, like you say.
Yeah, I think that's sometimes what I say to people is inner change before outer change, because we all have kind of limiting beliefs. And if we can really reflect on them and really analyze where are they coming from, because a lot of times they come from family or they come from society. Maybe they're not actually our own. They've just kind of, we're just adapted them from what we're being told. And sometimes they can really restrict our potential to really live our lives and to do what we really want to do.
So in many ways, the biggest system change that you've done in your entire life, more than the car parks and everything else, is that you've done the systems change on yourself.
Exactly. And I believe it's because of the systems change within myself that has enabled the outer systems change. I believe that if the inner system change didn't happen, then neither would the outer system change. And I can even give like examples. Like when I was doing the NHS campaign, 1 week after Chelsea Westminster made their decision to start charging for disabled parking, there was a summit at the King's Fund where Matt Hancock, this was in 2019, our Minister of Health and Social Care, was doing the keynote speech. So after he does his keynote speech, there's an opportunity for Q&A. So I probably had like a few seconds of a window of opportunity to put my hand up before anybody else. And what was going through my mind at that time, by challenging the NHS, I also realized I was potentially kissing my whole career goodbye within the health system, because the life expectancy of a whistleblower is not so good. Because I'd done that work, I gave the evidence base, the systematic violation of disabled people's rights, disability being one of the strongest predictors of poverty, only one third of tube stations being accessible. I explained to the audience what was happening in Chelsea Westminster Hospital and the campaign. When I mentioned the campaign, the whole audience applauded the campaign, and I asked the minister for his support. And as politicians so often do, he ignored the question. And then I also approached Simon Stevens, who was the CEO of NHS England, the so-called most powerful person in the NHS. Again, evidence-based campaign, what's happening in Chelsea Westminster. And all he could do was just laugh at me for 5 minutes. Like, how audacious you think you can challenge the NHS? Who are you? But the world works in mysterious ways. There were journalists in the audience from the Times and the Telegraph. They contact me on LinkedIn. I leave the conference. I interview with the Times and the Telegraph. Then the Daily Mail contacts me the next day. So on the Monday of the Chelsea Westminster making their decision, a week later, we were published in the Times, the Telegraph, and the Daily Mail about the campaign. So it
Wow.
goes into the stratosphere. Then we have BBC London contact us. And then I start working with MPs from all the main political parties, from Labour, Tories, and Lib Dem. And then we managed to get it into the manifestos of the Conservative Party, of the Labour Party, and I got agreement by the Lib Dems. But I can also just bring it all the way back to those 2 seconds of after the minister's done his speech and they're asking for a person to put their hand up. And if I'm still worried in my head about losing my job within the NHS, if I still have that limiting belief, that 2 seconds would just go and somebody else would put their hand up and maybe I wouldn't have been picked. And then we wouldn't have got the publicity that would have been the kind of launch for the campaign. So it kind of also shows this inner change is so critical to really seize the moment, as they say in Latin, carpe diem.
The something you skated over in the conversation really briefly, you really skated over it was you were a torchbearer at the Paralympics in 2012. That's amazing.
Yeah, it was such a great honor. It really did transform my life. That opened up the opportunity then for me to become a trustee with Level Playing Field. It opened up the opportunity for me to join so many organizations. And I also just really started to reflect upon what's my role, what's my purpose in what I do. Is it just to accrue wealth? Is it just to have a bigger house and a bigger car? Or do I actually really want to focus on transforming systems and helping people? And that also helped to this aspect of reframing. So I'd say that was, it ended up being one of the most kind of significant moments in my life, for making a change.
That's brilliant. And the other thing you skated over a little bit is that you were an investment banker back in the day.
Yeah, so when I left I did a management science degree.
Okay.
And then originally I worked for the BBC, for Bloomberg, and I was at Lehman Brothers in 2005. And I left Lehman Brothers because I felt them to be one of the most arrogant organizations I'd worked for. And I remember at that time, my cousins in India were saying to me, no one leaves Lehman Brothers. They employ the top 1% and the top 1% of them. And I just said, they're really arrogant. I don't want to work for them. My dad had a triple heart bypass operation, and they didn't let me basically go be with him the next day, even when I didn't have any work on. And I just thought that's so unethical, even though I offered to come in weekends and kind of make up the time. Went and did an MBA. And I was at Morgan Stanley when Lehman's collapsed. And then that's when I really started to reflect on what's my purpose in life. Is it just to accrue wealth? Or is it to really help people? And then I tried, I set up a charity called Choice International to help disabled people in places like India and the developing world. Didn't really go according to plan, not really systems change level. And it was the Olympics, London 2012, that then opened up all these doors and opportunities that provided an opportunity to create systems change. Because to create systems change, you also need a seat at the table,
Yeah.
because you need to know what's happening in the system. But the problem is that if you have a seat at the table and you're employed by the system, then that restricts your ability to challenge the system. So I was in a very fortunate halfway house being a governor of a hospital trust, where I'm essentially a volunteer, but a volunteer who appoints the chair and the non-executive directors. But I wasn't employed by the trust, so I was still able to be a critical friend and to challenge the trust, which is my role being publicly elected. So it's kind of fortuitous timing, being at the right place at the right time and having the courage to speak truth to power.
There's lots of things, isn't there, all at the same time. There's the ability to make systems change on yourself, and there's the ability to do all those things and to push yourself and to make the changes. But there's also the being in the right place at the right time and managing to get your hand in the air, and just all of those things kind of coming together at the same time to make you the person that you are.
And I think this is also comes down to faith and belief. Because if I'm completely honest, like the system wouldn't have transformed if it wasn't for the general election in 2019. The general election was two main factors. One was the NHS, one was Brexit, where the Tories were strong. The other one was the NHS, where the Tories were weak. So they looked at my campaign and they extended it to long-term inpatients, parents of sick children, and NHS night staff. But the only thing they implemented permanently was the disability element to exempt blue badge holders. Because when does a person become a long-term inpatient? So this timing is really critical as well. And sometimes we really don't know what the right time is. I kind of think of it like a bit like a boat. So there's lots of boats outside, and you're going sailing to find a destination. And you have to have the faith and belief when you do that. And sometimes the stars will just align when you're out at sea and you'll get to where you want to go.
Brilliant. It's been fantastic talking to you. It's been really opportune. You're down in Cornwall, so we're down in Cornwall, so it's our paths have crossed, and we've managed to get this hopefully recorded somewhere in a cloud or on a computer, and it'll
Wonderful.
be released soon, hopefully. But listen, thank you very much for your time. It's been an absolute privilege to speak to you.
Yeah, it's been a real honor to speak with you, Theo. Hopefully we can meet in person one day.
Let's hope so. That's great. Thank you very much, Kush.
Please let me know when it's published so I can kind of share it on my social medias and stuff.
Absolutely will do. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Wishing you a wonderful weekend. All the best.
Likewise.